This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 31st of May, 2022. And we're looking at a market that is getting some fresh headwinds from multiple directions. Crude oil, we mentioned it yesterday, certainly getting worse after new sanctions against Russian imports in the EU. I'll get to Ola in a moment on that. But also, as we have fresh noise from the Fed, Board of Governors member Waller talking about multiple 50 basis point moves until things sort of the beatings will improve, until morale improves, headline there. And then Biden summoning Powell to the White House for a discussion today. We'll get to all of that. But first, we need to go to you, Ola, because as we talked about on yesterday's podcast, with oil closing last week at the second highest weekly close for the cycle, the risks around the fresh EU discussions on an oil or a deepening of the oil restrictions, Russian oil import restrictions to the U.S., into Europe, driving fresh concerns. That's indeed what we have, $124 nearly on Brent crude overnight. Take us through the specifics of these latest restrictions and what your outlook is here.
Well, it's been a long time coming, John, these negotiations within the EU, because obviously we know that Hungary has been putting up several obstacles, because they are not only they are very friendly with Russia, but they are also receiving the bulk of their, well, all their oil through pipelines, the old Soviet Union pipelines that was put in place to support the countries of the old Warsaw Pact. That was solved, and that basically means that an import ban will be rolled out now over the next 6 months. It will initially cover seaborne imports into Europe, which accounts for around 2/3 of the total. You can see that here on slide 8. I also put in a graphic from Bloomberg just highlighting these current pipelines. The imports by pipelines is around 700,000 barrels a day last year, but obviously the bulk of that is heading to Poland and Germany, and they have both indicated that they will turn off the tap as soon as possible. So that basically will leave the total impact on Russian exports to Europe around 90%. That will obviously come at a cost to consumers in Europe, that's for sure. At the same time, it will also come at a cost to Putin, which is obviously the whole idea. He will have to divert shipments to Asia now and find buyers over there into a market where he's probably have to accept a discount of anywhere between $30 and $40 per barrel. So obviously his revenues will be hurt by this, but obviously in Europe, we will be hit in our pockets as well. We can see on the gasoline and diesel price, how elevated they are right now. Just want to mention we are heading for the 6 monthly gain in crude oil. We haven't seen a string of consecutive monthly gains of this length for more than a decade. And in the bottom right corner, you can just see what performance we've seen during this time. And it's clearly that, yes, the focus is on Brent and WTI up around 90%, but really the damage and what we as consumers can feel is the impact on diesel and gas oil, which is used for diesel production in Europe, and gasoline as well, up more than 100%. So this is painful, and with China reopening at the same time, and with that an expectation of demand picking up, then obviously the upside risk remains very much elevated.
Yeah, and I'm really curious on the second and third round effects of all this, when you have other major countries that are importing Russian oil at these heavy discounts to the great financial benefit of themselves relative to what Europe is having to suffer, and then the risk of sanctions. For example, you have a lot of the traditional EU and especially German surplus, external surpluses, trade surpluses are into Chinese demand. And here you have a terrible restriction on the economy from high energy prices. And then there's importing things from China that are based on production that might've been happening, or economic activity that's been happening on cheaper Russian imports. It's just, I'm fascinated by the composition effect of this globally as we work through the implications of this in coming months. Okay, let's zoom back to the market. We did not have the U.S. markets open yesterday, but we had plenty of U.S. developments late yesterday, with the Fed's Waller, as mentioned, talking about several 50 basis point hikes. And we're seeing the U.S. futures rolling over a bit here. And I think some of that is the oil situation as well. Peter, we don't have really a roundup because there was no action in the U.S. market yesterday, but technically I think it's important to look at where, if this move is starting to fail, where does it start to fail badly? And it's not really failing badly until we're well back below the 4,100 area that was the previous pivot high. and especially the 3958, 61.8% retracement of this very steep squeeze we've seen off the lows from a little over a week ago. Your take on the market, and I think the more interesting discussion you have brought today is about a little follow-on to our special edition podcast last week on bear market rallies.
Yeah, so I'm actually looking more right now at the Nasdaq 100. I think it expresses the where the hope is the most and where the most of the buy the dip mentality is being expressed. So right now, as we speak, we're trading at 12,666 on those futures. And that means that we are actually trading below Friday's close on those Nasdaq 100. And I think if we have a meaningful close below Friday's close, I think we have a technical signal in the market that things could be wind down pretty quickly here. We were potentially going for 13,000, but it doesn't look like that's the case. And for all the reasons that Ole mentioned, and that was also what I said on the internal call, you're not going to have a happy days mentality in the equity market as long as we have an energy crisis that is galloping and becoming worse and worse. So, but coming back to the drawdowns, because we have put out two equity notes in the past couple of weeks on drawdowns, but then we did the special edition podcast, as you mentioned, John, that was featured last week. And now we did a follow-up. So because we had this more than 6% rally, 6.5%, I think, rally in the S&P 500, we looked at the different drawdowns, the 15 largest drawdown that will include the current one we're in, which is the 15th largest since 1928. And we looked at the something called the rebound. So what is a rebound is defined in our methodology as a move, percentage move from the recent low at that given point in time you're in. So you can actually see it as an inverse of the drawdown, basically. And then a rebound is finished and registered, accounted, if you're up 5% from a recent low and you then revert back and make a new low. And you can see we've already had 2 5% rebounds in the current drawdown, if you will. And what I try to show here with both the 5% but also the 10% rebounds, we're on slide 3, by the way, is that they're not an indication or any good predictor for what the shape or what the current or future path of the drawdown would be. So I think we have to, this is a public service warning here, because a lot of people that are out there cheering for buy the dip, and I, you know, personally I would also like to see equities higher, but that's, I don't think will happen. And 5% rebound is not a signal necessarily that we have hit the bottom. That's the main message here. And then very quickly, if you look at the tables, we have something called the intensity. And the intensity, maybe it's a little bit the wrong word, but I use it as how intensive things are. And actually, the drawdown, the lower this value is, the fewer trading days we were in a 5% rebound stage. So I've put in the S&P 500's drawdown from 1961 to 1962, because if you look at that, you have an intensity ratio for that drawdown at only 3.7%. So only in 3.7% of the days we traded above the 5% rebound. And that rebound came in late May, as you can see on the chart there. So in other ways, it was a very, very, very intense drawdown, because you were down 28% with very little rebound.
Yeah, and then I like your perspective there on the 2000 to 2002 bear market. 42% of the time, if you look at the bottom table, for 10% rebound. So during that whole period, for 42% of the time, so nearly half, not that far from half the time, you were more than 10% off of whatever the low was. So perhaps thinking that this was the it, and you were getting back to the upside focus again, only to be disappointed with fresh lows. Cycle. So yeah, very interesting perspective there, and I think it just shows you how many rebounds you can get within the bear market context. Especially, I think the options market adding to that volatility risk on both ways in modern markets relative to something back in the 60s or 20s, whatever. All right, and then you also mentioned that we've sort of raised this before. It's been a very different market volatility wise. So the VIX behavior in this bear market has not been the VIX behavior of previous markets of recent date. And so it's just indicating, like you say on slide 4, that we really haven't seen the capitulation trade yet, at least if that is supposed to be accompanied with a significant blowout in VIX behavior.
No, exactly. I mean, this current drawdown has been quite unusual in the sense that it has, I would argue, been quite orderly. You know, liquidity has been there. We've just steadily gone lower and lower. We have had these 2-5% rebounds. But as you can see on slide 4, the curvature of the VIX forward curve has not really inverted. So the VIX index itself hasn't shot up relative to future volatility levels priced in VIX futures. And as you can see with these big ice taps there, 4 times since 2015, all mark the absolute bottom in those sell-offs. And when you reach a very, very, very inversion in that VIX forward curve, it typically tells you that we have had the capitulation mode setting in and liquidity disappearing from the system. And that's typically a very good turning point in the market. And we just haven't seen it. And I think that combined with the rebound and drawdown discussions we've had, you and I, John, and the galloping energy crisis that Ole mentioned, I just see this this market going lower for now.
Yeah, and small translation note, ice taps would be icicles for English speakers out there, just to tease you on a false a false word into the English language.
Thank you, Josh.
East tap in Danish is icicles in English. So what you mean is, of course, the spikes that look like icicles in that chart there. Let's look at some of the proximate causes of the fresh dollar surge here, and I think also behind a little bit of the headwinds for risk sentiment. And that is a fresh little jump here in the U.S. yields, as mentioned with Waller commenting. He's on the Board of Governors commenting on these 50 basis point hikes. So I have on slide 5, the 2-year and the 10-year. So the 2-year jumped about 5 or 6 basis points on the day. And because of the specific mention of several 50 basis point hikes this year, a lot of that is front loaded. So if you look at the December end point for this year, it's now priced at about 9 basis points higher than it was before his comments. It looks like on the 10-year, for example, there, it also jumped in quite a bit. Somewhere around 10 basis points from the range of the last few days, which is a very low energy range. And that consolidation, that may be over with. We may have found resistance in the 10 years and we're selling off again. So just interesting there. Of course, that becomes way more profound if we get above 300 basis points on the 10-year. I think that would be an important development. So far, it's just a sort of a rejection of this downside follow-through scenario. So we have to keep our eyes on yields. Very important across the board for both risk sentiment, but especially the U.S. dollar. And as I clipped from that headline from Bloomberg, Biden is going to meet Powell. And maybe he can get Powell to print some oil and some gasoline for this economy to get inflation levels down. Somehow I think that's going to be a tough challenge. But interesting to see if there any signaling develops in the wake of this meeting that refreshes the whole sense we've had for the cycle that this Powell Fed is now about getting ahead of inflation at all costs. We've seen a little bit of a softening of that since the May 4th FOMC meeting, but is this simply a political reminder? Look, Mr. Chairman, you need to get ahead of this curve any way you can. Running out of time, by the way, for any decent impact into the economy, into the consumer sentiment, I would argue, ahead of that November midterm election. Okay, and then I wanted to bring up a market that I should have brought up yesterday, but I'm with a very thin excuse that we were off for a couple of days late last week when all of the action was happening. The corporate credit space, we saw a tremendous backup in corporate credit, high yield spreads, for example, over the last few days. And some of this is likely the people were using these ETFs, for example, in the US, the J&K and the HYG, two ETFs that track and contain high yield bonds as a sort of hedge against deterioration in corporate credit quality. And that process had clearly been taken too far together with excessive bearish sentiment. And the backup has been quite considerable. So this has been part of the whole risk recovery squeeze we've seen in recent days. I've got a chart there on slide 6, by the way, of the J&K. And we've seen the one measure I track, this one Barclays high yield spread indicator. It was poking towards that 500 basis points level that was some see as key for the Fed's concern level on credit. And it was crushed about 70 basis points lower. So just to put it in terms of actual basis points terms from the highs in the spread to the levels, at least as of the close on Friday. So interesting developments there. And then this is supporting the dollar. And on slide 7, I bring up cable. So sterling versus the dollar as a favorite way to express a dollar comeback here. If U.S. yields are set to head higher, this could be a new pivot point for markets. Again, the Fed having to refresh its hawkish view, et cetera, especially if we get some U.S. data points through the end of the week and that jobs report on Friday and maybe even earnings. that indicate that the market has gotten a little ahead of itself in predicting peak inflation, peak Fed tightening anticipation. Meanwhile, some of the commodity currencies doing quite well. China's opening up a bit more in Shanghai. So interesting, the tension between sentiment and tighter liquidity from the Fed versus some support into the commodity space. I would expect the liquidity angle to win out if more energy gets injected across global markets here. But let's see on that front. All right, swinging back to the outlook for the economy, we have, and as I mentioned, the Chinese activity levels normalizing at least to a degree more in Shanghai. This has metals a bit on the bid here, but there's a lot of work to do to really shift the chart view, I would argue.
Indeed, John, and it's actually the same situation we're finding in something like gold. I can see on your heat monitor there on the FX that we've still got a negative reading on both gold and silver, even though we've seen a recovery recently. And it just highlights the market is really in the need of a strong push, but a strong push higher to alleviate some short-term bearish scares. But you mentioned industrial metals, and the focus there, just like oil, to a certain extent as well, is the reopening of China. And I think what is just interesting is just to take a look at what's been going on for the past few months. We've seen a top to bottom correction in the industrial metal sector by around 25%. During this time, you would have thought that the price was coming off due to expectations for lower demand, but inventory levels held by exchange monitored warehouses in London and Shanghai, has continued to drop. And it dropped again last week. So if we are seeing a recovery in China starting to unfold here, it's coming at a time where we not only do we have a net short position held by speculators in copper, we also have inventory levels of some of these key metals at very, very low levels historically. So that's why I'm basically in the headline there on slides 9 saying it's bears are potentially being challenged, and it's a difficult scenario to be bearish to industrial metals with this unfolding.
Right, and then we have on the agricultural front this hopeful news that there could be an opening in some kind of opening for a quarter, as you call it, to get some of these Ukrainian wheat supplies to the world.
Yeah, exactly. That is it's becoming increasingly a desperate measure or attempt, because we have to remember that Ukraine still has a lot of crop stock in their silos waiting to be exported. And obviously, with the even though the coming harvest will be significantly lower than what we expect in normal years, that harvest needs to go somewhere, and it needs to go back into these silos. So we need to have those silos emptied before the autumn and the harvest period starts. And that's really a race against the clock now. Otherwise, we could basically end up with the billions of tons of crops being just rotting in the fields. So this is key for the market over the coming weeks. There's a lot of political discussions going on, and it's a difficult one to agree on, but see whether it happens. Because at the same time, if you look at crop conditions both in the US and in Europe, it's not looking good. We have the top one, which is from Bloomberg, just showing the condition of the wheat in France, which is the biggest production area in Europe. The quality rated the quality percentage dropped to 69% last week, and it's down from 80% a year earlier. So same situation in Europe or in the US. So we really need to get some wheat to the market from Ukraine. So that is the focus, and if we fail, wheat prices will continue to be very, very elevated.
Yeah, let's certainly hope not on that front. Okay, and then with earnings season still taking along, at least for a couple of companies, you've got a big name, at least in the speculative space, one of the ones that pumped to incredible levels, but was much later to roll over than some of the other stocks in that space. Peter, this Salesforce. So look at that chart. I mean, we peaked out for those really speculative high momentum equities, if I recall, is in Q1 of 2021, this one carried through all the way into very late 2021. So a bit of a different beast here.
Yeah, but it's, as we have talked about, there have sort of been two waves with the within the technology sector. So there has been the tier two and tier three ecosystem, if you will, very much propped up by ARK Invest and Cathie Wood. And a lot of those stocks, including the biotechnology sector, peaked out in Q1 of 2021, as you said, correctly said, so around mid-February. And then you had the tier one, so the the really large, very dominant technology companies, Salesforce, Nvidia, Microsoft, Meta, Alphabet, the whole group, they continued to into the high that we had in around November in NASDAQ 100, and then we peaked out in early January in S&P 500. So there's a lot of moving factors there. And Salesforce is one of the big technology companies. They are within the application industry. They are very much battling with Microsoft in a lot of the key applications. And as you say, they down a lot. They down almost 50% from the high. And as we talked about yesterday, this is just a quick repeat. They need to really show that they can increase margins very dramatically. This is the new environment we're in. You're not longer rewarded by the market from having high revenue growth. You're being rewarded from having cost discipline and improving your margins and your return on investor capital. So that is the key thing to watch tonight for Salesforce, which is reporting after the market close.
Okay, and then we go to the macro calendar. Very busy. I don't want to run through all of this, but looking at that conference board, consumer confidence indicator, I've talked about this endlessly, but we'll see where it stands versus that Michigan one, which is essentially about to plumb new depths in its history. And this one has only corrected slightly from the highs of the conference board indicator, with fewer questions that you can directly link to inflation. It's been more of a jobs market indicator in terms of coinciding indicators or coincident indicators in the past. May, a flash CPI out of the Eurozone, where they're expecting the 7.8% on the headline, core at 3.6%. I think it's with the core slips badly above it. It looks a lot worse. As long as the core is let's call it sub 4%, maybe doesn't look quite as egregiously irresponsible to running the current monetary policy. But we'll see. The latest core was 3.5% for April. I need to bring up one thing that our very sharp strategist out in Hong Kong, Redmond Wong, brought up to me, and that there was a revision overnight in the Japanese wage data for March, revised up to 2.0% from 1.2% previous estimate. This is really critical stuff, because if you start to see a consistent pattern of wages rising, it could shift the Bank of Japan away from its insistence on maintaining this yield curve control policy. And of course, you know, yields are never going to catch up to where they are in the rest of the world in Japan, but just this simple adjustment would be a massive event that could trigger a sort of a stepwise reassessment of the Japanese yen. So just wanted to flag that story. It's really important. And as well, the political signaling as we get to new highs in oil prices, if there's complaints on the cost of living and the link of that into the weak Japanese yen, I think there'd be at some point these higher energy prices become a political liability for the Bank of Japan's persistence in pursuing that policy. We have Japanese Prime Minister Kishida outlining a so-called new capitalism unquote plan with trying to iron out inequalities. I don't want to get into too many details on that, but watch for that headline too, or look, have a look for yourself what that platform is all about. And then Peter, you mentioned this morning in the internal call, Sweden's GDP disappointing at minus 0.8% in Q1 versus the minus 0.4% expected. And we have to note that Sweden has an absolutely insanely egregiously overleveraged housing market, massive private debt associated with that. And as the Riksbank has been one of the really big movers in terms of shifting its forward rate tightening trajectory, if that trajectory is realized, there's going to be massive pressure on the Swedish economy from a hangover in housing prices, which can only be heavily impacted by a rise in rates. So we're going to watch for that those developments in Sweden in coming months. I think that's all I mentioned on the calendar overview. Have a look on slide 12. There's quite a few little bits and pieces for today, the Hungarian rate decision, and I believe they might be not quite truthful, I'll put it that way, on some of the CPI reports, because you have the Polish CPI out this morning expected at 13.6% versus 12.4% in April. These are very heady inflation levels, and supposedly Hungary is running with much lower inflation levels despite way, way higher wage growth, a part of that on the election splash on fiscal, and despite a much weaker currency. So I'm still watching Hungary for the risk of a devaluation at some level on the Hungarian forint. That is a wrap for today. Let's stay careful out there. Interesting to see if we're getting a pivot point here again in markets as the U.S. comes back online after its three-day holiday. We'll see how things stand tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.